proceeding to the second of three oral arguments this morning. Judges Bentley and Riley joining me, Judge Sleater. A240427 is our current proceeding. Mark Weber et al. Respondents, Jeffrey R. Brockberg et al. Are appellants. We do remind counsel that please identify yourself and who you represent when you begin your comments this morning. We are recording this proceeding, and the recording will be made available within 24 hours on the First Judicial Branch website. Also, there is a button on the front of the podium so you can adjust its height to your liking. Also, make sure to pay attention, of course, to the clock that's on the podium as well. And with those comments, counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may approach and identify yourself and then begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joseph Ganji. I represent the appellants in this matter, Jeffrey Brockberg and Deborah Brockberg. I'm here today to ask the court to reverse the district court's summary judgment, primarily because the district court awarded speculative and unrealized damages. The legal principles regarding damages are fairly straightforward. They're well established. You cannot award speculative damages. You cannot award theoretical damages or damages that are unrealized. The plaintiff at all times retains the burden to prove that it has suffered an actual damage, and that has not happened in this case. And there's three key areas that I'd like to discuss, point out to the court here today, to illustrate why and how the actual damages here have not been sustained and the district court should be reversed.
Mr. Ganji, before you do that,
yes.
Just to clarify, your client did not, there was no opposing an accounting done other than the one of, was it Cray, I think was the name?
Cray, I believe.
Cray. And in fact, I understand from deposition, your client didn't disagree with the numbers identified in Mr. Cray's analysis. And it seems like that's the numbers that showed the in and out, the credits along with the withdrawals that were part of the conceded breach of fiduciary duty. And so I guess the question I have is, what facts did your client present in the record to create a genuine issue of material fact of opposing those numbers that are on that chart that added up to the judgment that the court ordered?
Sure. So the numbers are were not necessarily opposed at the ground level by my client. They took a position that was more broad than the numbers. So their position was there hasn't been realized damage to begin with, so they can't, South Walker Bay can't be awarded damages as a matter of law. That's the first piece to it. The second piece to it is the factual part of it, where should there be evidence that there has been a sustained damage, then summary judgment is not appropriate because there are genuine issues of material fact on whether or not the damage has in fact been sustained. And we see that through various facts in the record that's not tied directly to the numbers, but through other facts in the record, such as the Brockbergs' intent to take personal loans. We see that the Brockbergs treated the money as their personal property. We see that the Brockbergs made payments on the loan. So when you have the First National Bank payment on the loan, for example, you will see often the amount of money in the bank account. The Brockbergs are putting that into the account roughly before or after and then making the payment. So it's treated as a personal expense. Not that I'm condoning that behavior by any means, but these are facts where a jury could look at it and say, yeah, South Walker Bay didn't actually sustain a damage because the Brockbergs were using this as a personal loan and they treated it as a personal loan.
What's the relevance of how they treated it versus the fact that South Walker Bay was the signatory or the actual party on the loan? So I'm just curious why that matters from assessing damages, how they treated the property.
And I think a good example to answer that question, Your Honor, is the SBA loan. This we haven't talked a lot about the SBA loan because the South Walker Bay didn't claim that as damage. But that's precisely why I think it's relevant here. Just for the court's reminder, the SBA loan was another loan. It was about $40,000 or so that Mr. Brockberg took out. He took it out in the name of South Walker Bay. He took the money got deposited into the bank account. He took that money out. He used it for personal purposes. And then he paid that money back with his own account. And South Walker Bay did not claim that money as damages. Nor could they, because they, even though the money came out of the South Walker Bay account, they didn't suffer an actual damage from that because the loan was paid off through non-company funds. And the same thing is going on, really, with these other loans. The money, yes, it's in the name of South Walker Bay. However, we have the additional piece to it where the Brockbergs have personally guaranteed the loan. There's the extra mortgage of the Brockbergs' own property. And then they're treating it the same way as they did the SBA loan, where they took the money right away, used it for personal purposes, and now we're at a point where what's going to happen? Are they going to pay it back? Are the lending institutions going to get that money back through other means, through the personal guarantee, through the foreclosure of the Brockbergs' own property? Are the Brockbergs going to pay that back on their own? There's these open questions that result in the South Walker Bay not actually sustaining a damage at this point in time.
So, but maybe does that distinguish the loan, the SBA loan you're talking about, which has been paid off, so that's done, whereas these, the loans we're talking about are still alive? So that to some, I'm just trying to, and whether that is an important distinguishing point as to whether there is or isn't an existing damage? Because it seems like with the loan that's closed, maybe that answers there's been no damage and there's no potential for future harm.
Right. And so we don't have that here with the other loans because they're still out there. They're still outstanding. But maybe another good point to make would be in relation to the respondent's own brief, where they argue that if the loans here are paid off by other means, we can go back to the district court and say and get a satisfaction of the judgment to South Walker Bay. I don't really follow that logic. However, that's no different than going to the court and saying, Judge, remember when we said that we suffered an actual damage from these loans? Well, it turns out we didn't. Just kidding. And so you should subtract that amount from our judgment. Well, we shouldn't be doing that after the fact. We should be, the plaintiff has the burden of establishing now that the damage has been actually suffered. And they cannot do that at this point in time.
Counsel, I'm not sure I follow that argument. It seems like, and that gets back to the numbers, there was no dispute. First, there's a concession, of course, that these loans, the breach was taking it out in the LLC's name. And so those numbers are reflected, and then the money is taken out. And so there's a harm right there. It's a dollar for dollar, and until such time as they're paid off, the LLC is responsible for paying these loans. But the Cray accounting also accounts for payments that were made, so those are those red numbers. So I'm not understanding what's prospective. It strikes me that the prospective nature, and has to do with post-judgment proceedings, is, yeah, how the creditors will end up collecting it might affect, but I'm assuming today if your client paid it off, he would move to have the judgment reduced, which would be an appropriate result because now it's been paid off and no longer is there an obligation of the LLC to pay it.
Right, and 2 points to that. So on the one hand, this is not a judgment against, the lenders don't have the judgment. So anything that happens with the lenders does not affect the South Walker Bay judgment. They are collecting right now, and should they collect all of the money right now and it's later paid off by other means, there's no recourse. Now you've paid, basically the Brockbergs will have to have paid twice.
Why would they pay twice?
Because the South Walker Bay has collected from the Brockbergs, and now the lending institution still has that open loan. Paying South Walker Bay doesn't pay the lender. There are two different parties there. South Walker Bay can do whatever they want with the money that they collect from the Brockbergs.
Except that they have two roughly, according to Mr. Cray, $2 million in outstanding loans, and the assets of the LLC are $1.2
million. Correct. Correct. And that's a great point, Your Honor, because the district court awarded the LLC the $2.2 million.
Well, because your clients agreed to a pretty outrageous interest rate when they took those loans out, 30% per year.
Understood. However, the lending institution can only collect from South Walker Bay the amount that it has. And so the maximum that the lending institution could ever collect from South Walker Bay would be the value of the property, which was the $1.2 million. And then you're going to have that extra $1 million with the interest and the other loans. Where is the lending institution going to go for that? Well, they're going to go to the Brockbergs for that. And when they go to the Brockbergs for that, whether it's through their personal guarantee or whether it's through their own mortgage, now the Brockbergs are paying $1 million on top of that to the lending institution when they've already had that $1 million part of the judgment to South Walker Bay. They're paying twice. So, Judge Sleater, I would disagree that the LLC is responsible for the loan. They are, but they're not the only ones responsible for the loan. And maybe that's what distinguishes this situation from other situations, because the lending institutions have other means to collect.
Well, maybe think about it this way. Like, what, you know, let's say that South Walker Bay wanted to relieve itself of the burdens of the loans. So as a, when we think of damages, trying to put the party who was damaged back in the position that it would have been absent the breach, right? So at this moment, by the judgment of including the amount of the current existing loans, would allow them to then pay off the loans and relieve that burden, right? How else would they, absent giving them, you know, and somehow either your clients or someone else paying down these loans in the meantime, how else would you get South Walker Bay back to whole in this moment as a result of the breach?
That's true, Your Honor. However, nothing is requiring South Walker Bay to do that. So South Walker Bay collects from the Brockbergs on their own judgment. South Walker Bay can do with that money whatever they want. It does not affect the loans. The loans are still there, and should they decide not to pay, then we have the lending institution foreclosing, and if they foreclose against South Walker Bay, they're only going to get the $1.2 million from South Walker Bay.
I mean, maybe there would be some way, you know, in that event, the lending company doesn't come after them, they go after the Brockbergs. Brockbergs have to pay the whole source of the loan, or maybe you don't have the funds, so then the lender does come after South Walker Bay. I mean, at some point, or maybe there's some indemnity, I mean, I don't know all the procedure. I mean, it seems like there's probably some other way to get at that problem later, so that it, I guess correct me if I'm wrong about that.
I don't know that there is, Your Honor. I mean, we've got a judgment, and the judgment can be enforced, and it's being actively enforced right now. There's garnishment summons all over the place trying to collect on the judgment. What South Walker Bay does with that is up in the air. The real question is whether or not the damage has been actually sustained at this point, and it hasn't, because it's still theoretical. It's still out there. We don't know that South Walker Bay will actually suffer that damage, and so it was error to award them those damages. I know it seems counterintuitive, because the Brockbergs did what we're all saying is something wrong. They breached their fiduciary duties, but we still have to hold South Walker Bay to proving their actual damages in this case, and just the loan itself is not getting there.
I'm trying to think, if we agreed with your argument and it goes back to a fact finder, what different would the LLC need to present at trial for damages than what they presented? Because everything you're referring to are these prospective kind of post-judgment, you know, will the bank come after to foreclose? Will your client continue to pay? And what will they do with the money? And whether, so, but that's all future. I'm not sure what different they would present.
Yes, exactly, Your Honor. That's all future. It's all theoretical. So as of right now, because there hasn't been proof that an actual damage has been sustained, they simply don't get the damage. It's a legal question at this point. Yes, it's been decided on summary judgment, but as a matter of law, we cannot award them those damages. So from the judgment that they've been granted, we need to subtract all the theoretical damages from
that. Does the heart of your argument really go to the entire breach of fiduciary duties a premature cause of action until and if there's a foreclosure happens, even though clearly they're obligated for...
Potentially. So to come forward in court, you have to prove actual damages, and we're not at that point yet. So that may be fair to say. I see I'm nearly out of time. I don't think I can start a new topic, so I'll sit down and save time for a rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal, of course. Counsel for a respondent, when you're ready, you may approach, identify yourself, and then you can begin your comments.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Bradley Kletcher of Barna Guzzi and Steffen, on behalf of the respondents in this matter. This case, in its very essence, is about a severe breach of trust by Jeffrey and Deborah Brockberg as Board of Governors members and officers to the company that they are part of or were part of and the individual members who are there. The damages they sustained and that South Walker Bay sustained are undisputed. At the lower court level, there was no dispute offered as to the accounting presented by Darren Cray. The only thing that is theoretical is the defendant's, appellant's, theoretical viewpoint of what might happen in the future. Their theoretical viewpoint doesn't change the actual damages sustained by South Walker Bay in this matter. And it doesn't change those damages because those damages happened the instant those proceeds were taken by the appellants. They took them when the money belonged to South Walker Bay, and they used them for their own personal uses. They knew that at the lower court level. That's why they didn't dispute the accounting. As their attorney said, you can't argue with the accounting. There's a paper trail there, and there is a paper trail there. And that's what Darren Cray testified to and put forward in his affidavit. And there was no genuine issue of material fact to that, and they don't raise any genuine issue of material fact. To this day, they presented no argument about anything that wasn't accounted for in the accounting. They didn't at the lower court level, and they don't raise it here.
How do you address their, what I'll call windfall argument, that if we end up affirming here that South Walker Bay may end up with, you know, this amount of money that then they don't actually have to use to pay off the loans, and so they may end up somehow getting, and if the other side ends up having to pay the loans off, that South Walker Bay comes away with more than what they are entitled?
That is a theoretical argument. That is exactly the point. The damages are sustained right away. Theoretically, down the road, we may never collect a dime against them. And that's the same, frankly, what I think is going to happen. I think their Ponzi scheme has finally come up, and I don't think they're going to have any assets for anybody to collect against unless you had a mortgage on their real estate. I think that's just the reality of the situation. But again, it's a theoretical viewpoint from them, not an actual. At the time that it happened, the damage is sustained. They could have always paid it back at some point in time, but they never did before we had a judgment entered. If we'd wait, what would we have to do? Wait until someday down the road something happens? I mean, you have to have a finite point where the damage occurs, and the damage occurred as soon as they took that money. As soon as they took that money, we had the inability as South Walker Bay to pay back these loans. As soon as they did that, the company was damaged.
So would you agree if today or tomorrow the Brockbirds paid off directly to the lender completely, that and perhaps there's, I realize there's some overage perhaps of other money separate from that, but for the most part they could go in, they would ask for a reduction of the judgment, and your client would agree?
Absolutely. I think that's would be the appropriate manner to go about it if they wanted to contest that at a later date.
On the other hand, Mr. Ganji makes a point, if they paid it to your client wouldn't be obligated to pay the loan. Is that where there could be a double recovery of some form then?
Well, we would never have a double recovery because we're not getting double recovery. I mean, theoretically, they would make a double payment under that. That's not a double recovery because we're not getting a double recovery.
And your point, that doesn't make the current damages speculative.
That's correct. That's exactly right. And that, again, we're dealing with their theoretical things of what could happen in the future, and that's not the test. That's not the argument. The question is, at this point in time, are we damaged by them taking the money? And South Walker Bay is, because they can't take the money and pay the loans back. They're left chasing them, trying to come up with a way to collect on this judgment to be able to pay it off. And frankly, I think that's an unlikely outcome, given what I've seen so far.
Can I ask you about your cross-appeal? You had asked for reversal of the dismissal of the individual members, though you don't, I didn't see an analysis involving the direct action by member, but isn't it true that let me ask it a different way. You had four different counts, as I recall, involving the members. One was the breach of fiduciary duty, which the judge did address directly based on the inability of a direct action because it could not be a derivative. That's the LLC's claim. And then you had three different counts involving three different statutes, one involving the oppressive nature, the other having to do with requesting an accounting, and I think the other was just requesting documents. What, if any, different remedy did your client ask for? I didn't see it in the complaint for those individual claims other than what's already been obtained as a judgment by the LLC.
There are actually two different things we were asking for specifically as our remedy. And one was the dividends we would have received that we didn't receive, which totaled $57,000. And we didn't receive those dividends as a result of the conduct that they engaged in. And the second part that we asked for was an accounting of it. And of course, the accounting was never provided. We had to go do the accounting ourselves in the particular case and spent attorney's fees and money on the expert accountant to go do those kind of things.
So that's kind of resolved itself. You had to do it. So I guess that's part of my question is it all derives, including the $57,000, I'm assuming, by the same math Mr. Curry did, to come to the judgment, correct? So because of the dollar amounts, the LLC had the inability to send out what it would have paid was $57,000 per member.
That's true, but I think the difference is, and if you look at the statute of bringing a direct action, you're only barred from recovering your damages if it's solely the result of damage to the corporation. This isn't solely the result of damage to the corporation. Their failure to provide the information to my clients would allow them to discover this earlier, cut these loans off. The First National Bank of Walker loan was made back in 2015. If we had learned of that, we could have stopped all these other loans from happening and we'd be in a way better condition.
I appreciate that, but I guess my question is, but that is what led to the $2+ million of damages.
It is. That was the start of going to the $2 million damage. But my point is, it's not solely the result of damage to the corporation that we're not getting our dividends. It's also the result of us not getting the information, because had we received that information, we could have cut that off, and we would have been able then to receive our dividends. So under the statute, because it says it has to be solely due to the damage to the corporation, it's not solely due to that. It's also due to the violation of our rights and failure to provide the information that they were supposed to provide. You also have to keep in mind, Your Honors, that earlier in the case, we had a stipulation to remove them as managers and governors from the board of directors. At that time, only the individual members were plaintiffs. And so they were getting that relief on the theory that they weren't provided this information, there was going to be damage to the company. So they went forward and obtained that specific relief at that point in time, under those statutes for not getting that information. The difference is it never got contested, because they stipulated to after we filed the motion for a temporary restraining order, and the court entered that particular order in the case. So we have obtained relief related to those statutory violations in the case at an earlier point in time. And then that carried through at the end, where we sought to bar them from serving on the Board of Governors, serving as managers. That's also part of the relief that was eventually granted in the case. because having them be on the Board of Governors or the or be on the Board of Directors, Board of Governors, or be officers of the company would be very harmful given the conduct that they have engaged in this particular instance.
And would it be safe for me to describe the conversion claim as an alternate theory to obtain the remedy, the loss of the money, which you did get the judgment? And so if that's true, if we agree with your position and affirm the damages, that issue goes away, essentially, we wouldn't have to address it.
Yes, it really does go away. If you agree with us on the damages issue, it's just another theory to recover those particular damages. So it really does go away if you address that particular issue. I mean, from a legal perspective, it's obviously a very interesting issue in the state of Minnesota because there's no affirmative ruling on it one way or the other. And with the current status of cyber crime and people stealing money via the internet and taking intangible items, and also the fact that you could have an independent contractor who could break into somebody's computer in an office while they're working there and take that money to not have a remedy available, makes it, I think, a significant issue for the state of Minnesota to be able to make sure there's a remedy out there for that. And so that's frankly one of the main reasons I brought it before the court. But I think you're right. If you agree with me on the damages issue, it's probably an issue you don't have to reach.
Maybe you should raise it with the legislature.
may have to do so, Your Honor. I think it's a serious issue, and of course, as we all know, the common law develops and moves as society changes and has to be adaptable to it. And I think it ties into that specific kind of change in technology that's causing these issues. And it's similar to common law, where if you take funds that are, you know, right there, you can see, same way if you could specifically identify the funds transferred, you can specifically, it's just like a pile of money. It's no different. And so I think that's where the law needs to develop and go to make sure that there's a remedy available. I have a hard time seeing a downside to it happening, but I think it does give an upside because it makes sure there's a remedy always available for those instances where you don't have a duty of loyalty or a breach of fiduciary duty claim to protect somebody. And I think that's where it becomes a very important thing.
Counsel, could you address the issue of attorney's fees and how the district court applied Section 322C.0906 as a basis for the attorney's fee award?
Certainly, Your Honor. Essentially, what the district court found is a breach of fiduciary duty is an equitable claim. And because it's an equitable claim, we can fashion equitable relief. And since had this been brought as a derivative action, the court could have awarded attorney's fees. It makes logical sense that we should be able to award attorney's fees here as well, because this was really pushed on by the minority members. And it was our motion for TRO, where they got appointed to the board, that allowed us to bring a direct action. That really kind of changed how the case was. And so the court was basically of the viewpoint as you shouldn't be punished for how you went about getting this done, and that equity requires us to award those as attorney's fees in this particular case, and reference that statute for a basis for awarding them, recognizing that the legislature did say attorney's fees could be awarded in that type of situation, and it makes logical sense to extend that in this particular case. I also, under 322C.0701, subdivision 2, there's a provision that says the court can fashion relief for members as well and make it fit the particular circumstance. And because of that, it also ties into this ground of equity and being able to provide that. I mean, frankly, the attorney's fees incurred were largely due to the fact that we were going through trying to obtain the information to establish what was taken from the company, because it wasn't being provided. And so we had to subpoena records from banks, we had to subpoena records from individuals to track where this money went, to show that it was tied to their personal use and not their individual, or not the company's use. So that's all part of the expenditures that underwent in order to prove those kind of things. But that's a legal foundation for it. So it's based on the existence of a statute. Is that statute directly on point in this particular case? I think not. But I think the logical argument that the judge came up with makes sense to me. There's no case in Minnesota that says you can't do that in the context of a limited liability company. I know in Pedro v. Pedro, and that's a corporate case under 302A, they awarded attorney's fees in that particular case. And there is a statute that allows them to be awarded if something conduct was not in good faith or vexatious. But the two statutes have always been kind of construed side by side and followed side by side throughout the history in Minnesota. And so it would make sense that if you can get them there, you should be able to get them in this particular context as well. Your Honors, this is a situation where there has been vast amount of money taken from my client, leaving my client saddled with a large amount of debt, which all the individual members now have to pay into the company to cover it. And as a result of that, this is not some theoretical damage that has occurred. It's real, and it's continuing every day. Some of those members are here with me today to listen to this argument before this court, and it means a great deal to them. So I ask that the court affirm the decision on damages and the award of attorney's fees. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you'll now have 5 minutes rebuttal.
Mr. Ganji, how do you respond to opposing counsel's argument about attorney's fees and the basis for it?
Your Honor, 322C.0906 is not a fee-shifting statute. What that does is merely confirm that the American rule applies to these types of cases, because it only allows a plaintiff who, in a derivative action, would be the member to recover their attorney fees from the LLC's recovery. It does not shift the fees to the defendant. And so what it does is puts the corporation in the shoes of having brought the case and having, as if the corporation had to incur its own fees, but then requires the corporation to pay the member who actually had to pay it because the corporation did not bring their own direct action. The member was forced to do that. So it is not a fee-shifting statute to begin with. And you need a fee-shifting statute in order to award attorney fees contrary to the American rule. That does not exist here. And so as far as that attorney fee judgment goes, that should be reversed because there's no statutory basis for it. With respect to the argument that the damage was sustained the minute that the funds were taken from the account, a couple interesting points here, though. Even the accounting by Mr. Cray doesn't have all of that money isn't necessarily taken from the account. There was, $550,000 or so that was added interest on the loan. So it's not as if the Brockbergs came and took that money out of the account. We also have the dividends, which are part of the spreadsheet in respondent's brief of some $50,000 or so. These aren't funds that the Brockbergs actually took out of the account. What we're actually talking about is an obligation to repay. That's what the district court found. The district court looked at the damages and said there's an obligation to repay, and that is the damage, and that is the actual damage that that we're going to award. However, the obligation to repay alone, especially in this circumstance, is not a sustained damage when you have an obligation that's to other parties, especially with the personal guarantee and the other mortgage on the $800,000 loan on top of that. So we have these other bases
that you could point us to that supports that argument, or a situation like this where
the closest I could find was that I believe it was the Larson case, where you had the situation where somebody two parties suffered the same damage, so to speak. One party sold and they suffered damage because of the lost value to their property. The other one didn't sell, and so the court said, well, we can't award you damages at this point because you haven't suffered any actual damage. These are just applying the general principles of damages, which you cannot award the theoretical unsustained damages. Just merely taking the money out of the account here doesn't give that damage to South Walker Bay under these circumstances. The other argument, so that was the legal argument, but the other argument is the factual argument where just taking the money out of the fund, out of the account itself, there is a factual question on whether or not that was a damage to South Walker Bay based on how the Brockbergs treated the money, based on how the loans are set up, based on the other obligations that the Brockbergs have, and also based on the SBA loan as well, when the Brockbergs did the same thing. I don't have any other comments unless the court has other questions.
Appears to be no other questions. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today as well as the briefing. We will now take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling within 90 days. Have a good day.